This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 21st of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. We're live from Studio One of Monocle 24. I'm Christian Yeo. Coming up, we'll be discussing religious freedoms in Turkey as US officials call for the country to be reclassified a danger zone for minorities. And as Disney's John Carter hangs his head in shame, we'll be looking at the biggest flops in movie history.
John Carter looks to be one of the biggest losses in cinematic history, even worse than Cutthroat Island, which was $187 million.
And could Saudi Arabia be about to send its first female athletes to the London Olympics after months of pressure from international games organisers? And could the secret to a city's success be its smell? We chat to a flavour expert about the best smelling cities in the world. All that plus some great music as well. All to come in the next hour on Midori House with me, Christian Yeo. First, let's get a look at the news from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. In an unfolding drama that has riveted France and the world, about 300 police, some in body armour, have cordoned off a four-storey building in a suburb of Toulouse where the 24-year-old Muslim shooter, identified as Mohamed Merah, is holed up. Police say the suspect has told them he'd carried out his attacks to avenge the deaths of Palestinian children and because of the French army's involvement in Afghanistan. Police negotiators said he was a French citizen of Algerian origin who'd been to Pakistan and Afghanistan. The French President Nicolas Sarkozy said today that France should not give way to discrimination or vengeance after the shootings. But speaking on the briefing on Monocle 24, Tom Burgess-Watson, who's in France, says the attack has highlighted issues of racism in the current and previous presidential election campaign.
Sarkozy could stand accused of fanning the flames of intolerance during his 5 years in office, because after all it's on his watch, those face veil bans have come into effect, the question of halal meat. And just a short while ago, Sarkozy said that there are too many immigrants here in France.
Six Zimbabwean activists convicting of airing Arab Spring videos as part of a plot against President Robert Mugabe have been fined $500 and sentenced to 420 community service hours today, a milder punishment than the 10 years jail that could have been handed down. The group, led by a former opposition lawmaker in Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai's party, was found guilty of conspiracy to commit acts of public violence against Mugabe. In a major diplomatic blow for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Russia and China have now joined the Security Council in voicing support for UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan's bid to end violence that has brought Syria to the brink of civil war. Western diplomats said the agreement, on a statement voicing the gravest concern at the deteriorating situation in Syria, should be a wake-up call for Assad, who has counted on support from Russia to fend off international criticism of his year-long attempt to crush anti-government protests. Well, the Russian ambassador, Vitaly Churkin, said he would support a Syrian-led political transition of power, and he was satisfied with the wording of the resolution.
We are very pleased with the outcome of our discussions of the past 48 hours in the Security Council. We will support a Syrian-led political process. This is the aim of Kofi Annan's effort, and we'll support whatever the outcome of that process might be.
Some egg-centric news now, as biscuit and cake makers across Europe say they're having to cut back on baking because they're short of eggs and blame an EU ban on cross-border trade in eggs from small battery cages that are being phased out. Since the ban took effect in January, some suppliers have failed to meet their contracts because of the shortage, forcing bakers to buy eggs from supermarkets and keep producing. Even pasta makers were also being affected by the scarcity. Here, the British Finance Minister George Osborne has today cut the top rate of income tax while imposing new levies on the wealthy in a political high wire act designed to rejig the burden of austerity without wavering on plans to ease a huge budget deficit or erase a huge budget deficit. The government is aiming to erase a huge budget deficit which topped 11% of GDP before it took office within the next 5 years. The latest forecasts show it does remain on track.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, this budget rewards work. Britain is going to earn its way in the world. There is no other road to recovery. This budget supports working families and helps those looking for work. It unashamedly backs business, and it is on the side of aspiration, those who want to do better for themselves and for their families. This budget reaffirms our unwavering commitment to deal with Britain's record debts.
And finally, a bunch of keys carried as the Titanic sank are expected to fetch £60,000 at auction here in England. Samuel Hemming, a lamp trimmer, leapt out of bed nearly 100 years ago in April 1912 when the ship hit an iceberg. Told that it would sink within 30 minutes, he ran below to the lamp store, unlocked the door with the keys and carried lamps for the lifeboats up on deck four at a time. And after ensuring that all the lifeboats had lit lamps, he then dived into the sea and swam 200 yards to a lifeboat. His photograph is also up for auction on the 31st of March in Devizes here in Wiltshire. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. That was a nice story about the Titanic hero there.
Yes.
Who knew that the lampman had such a big role? But of course, pitch black, wasn't it, when it happened?
And so, nearly 100 years ago.
Such
amazing.
Yeah, it really is. Let's have a look at the front pages as people wake up in Australia and New Zealand. We'll start with The Age, which has actually quite a funnily apt picture there of a boat on fire in the Docklands area of Melbourne, raising questions about the fire service's ability to respond to fires on the waters around Australia. Two men in a tinny versus a raging Docklands inferno. And it really was a huge boat, a luxury yacht, which some reports suggest had only been bought by its owner the day before. And then it caught fire. Just looking down on The Age as well, big retailers hammered, profits down for Myer, 20%, also down for David Jones by the same amount, and Kathmandu down 43%. You've got retail analysts saying that David Jones in particular hasn't done enough to capture the online market, and they compare it with counterparts in the UK and the US like John Lewis and Neiman Marcus, who are doing a much better job at capturing online shoppers. The Sydney Morning Herald has a story about pharmacists using a loophole to boost profits. This is when drugs come off their patents and they become generics. And an industry body has literally been distributing leaflets to pharmacists on how they can cash in on this change once a patent's come to an end. And the price drops sometimes by as much as 90%. But the pharmacists still claim government subsidy to factor in the higher cost. So they've been cashing in quite a lot on that cost change for drugs. And also, just looking at the New Zealand press now, there's a very helpful diagram on how you can understand the new road law changes which are coming to effect, which will require people to give way. Left turners will have priority on the roads and right turners will have to give way. And the New Zealand Herald covers the nearly 300 sacked port workers of the Port of Auckland getting their jobs back, essentially, after talks resumed between the Port Authority. There were plans to replace the workers with contractors. Those plans have now been dropped. It's 8 minutes past the hour. Here we'll get a look at the global weather now with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
Well, yesterday marked the first day of spring across the Northern Hemisphere, and in Europe we've had some fairly nice weather. We'll notice the evenings getting lighter very soon too, because on the 25th the clocks will go forward by 1 hour to summertime. On the weather front at the moment, Spain as well as southern and western France is rather cloudy. Rain showers here and it's fairly cool too. But nice weather across Holland, most of Germany and into Austria. Here is Thursday's city outlook. In London, 15 degrees, it's partly cloudy. Zurich, 14, also partly cloudy. In Vienna, 16 with sunny skies. And in Oslo, very mild, 17 degrees and mostly sunny here too. Now across North America, the eastern states, well, we're continuing to see temperature records being broken. It is the hottest spring on record so far. In Chicago, for 10 days now, the temperature has been consistently way above the average. And on Tuesday, it was 30 degrees Celsius, hotter than you'd expect midsummer to be. It'll cool off end of the week and the weekend, but guess what? The heat wave will be back next week. And the warmth is now heading to New York State. So Thursday's city outlook, New York City 26 and sunny, June weather basically. Chicago 27 with sun and thunder showers. Minneapolis 22, also one or two showers. In Los Angeles, 20 degrees and sunny. And quickly around the world, in Shanghai, Thursday is looking warm and sunny, around 19 degrees, but Friday is much wetter. Tokyo, changeable weather here, around 13 degrees. And in Bangkok, of course, the hot, dry season right now, it's 37. That's all. I'm meteorologist Tomasz Szafranaker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomasz. It's 18:10 here in London, 05:10 if you're waking up in Melbourne, 07:10 in Auckland. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 in your cosmos.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Proper Jalapeno.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Now, US government officials have suggested Turkey be blacklisted by the international community in response to the country's limited religious freedoms. Turkey's been accused of abusing religious groups, particularly minorities. The Commission on International Religious Freedom called on the State Department to add Turkey, along with Tajikistan, be added to the State Department's list of countries of particular concern. It could see Turkey subject to sanctions if they don't improve religious freedoms. We have on the line now Ali Şakalu, a professor of political science at Koçi University of Turkey. Ali, firstly, from the sounds of it, Turkey is becoming less tolerant as time goes on, or is this just something that the US has now just started drawing attention to?
It's difficult to make a decision on that because we don't really know what used to happen in the past. But what's more important, I think, at this stage is that Turkey and the Turkish government's performance in protecting minority religious rights has serious problems. And I think it's an important diagnosis by the Americans at this point.
At the moment, what problems are faced by minorities in Turkey?
A number of issues have been highlighted in this report. One is the government has suffocating regulations, as the report says, and it denies full legal status to religious institutions. It fails to take action to correct the climate of impunity against religious minorities, for instance. I'm here almost quoting. The government fails to make the institutional reforms to reverse the conditions, and it intervenes in the internal governance and education of religious minorities, and it even apparently confiscates places of worship. It underlines again, I'm here following the report, anti-Semitism is on the rise, and this is especially alarming given the flotilla incident that we had between Turkey and Israel a number of months ago, and the media coverage of those events have been particularly alarmingly anti-Semitic.
Is this faith-based then? Are there any particular faiths that are seeing harsher treatment than others, or is it any religious sect within Turkey?
It looks like the Turkish state almost indiscriminately discriminates against all religion in Turkey. This is very absurd almost, but there are Muslim minorities as well as Muslim majority groups like the turban-wearing woman being treated in a discriminatory fashion by the state almost on a regular basis. So the report underlines that this is a general attitude of the state, the secular state, towards religion at large. But obviously some groups suffer more than others.
Now, many on this commission, or certainly at least a small group of them, have said this is not fair on Turkey to blacklist them in this way, as Turkey has begun rectifying many of the restrictions that are in place. And they say that to compare Turkey to countries like Saudi Arabia, Sudan, North Korea and Iran is misrepresentative.
I would agree with that. But I think this is primarily a political position, but it doesn't reflect on the importance of the principles of protecting minority rights. Now, one could easily give numbers, and I particularly like giving numbers, but on the issue of minority rights, numbers lose its meaning. In Turkey, we have a large sectarian minority of Alevis. By large, I mean approximately 15% of the population. We also have, different Hanafi Sunni subgroups of Sufi brotherhoods and tariqats. But non-Muslim minorities are very few in number. And the report, I think, in quite a balanced fashion, gives examples of oppression upon both of these groups, Muslim as well as non-Muslim groups. And I think in that respect, it justifies some kind of cautionary action towards the Turkish government to correct its policies in this field.
And looking outside of Turkey's borders, some of the suggestions have been that what's happened in northern Cyprus has also underpinned people's concerns about Turkey. Is that fair? I mean, does Turkey have an influence? Could Turkey change things in northern Cyprus more than it's doing so at the moment to create a more stable region politically?
That's a very tricky question, and it is tricky because although Turkey is seen by the UN as the occupying force in Cyprus, the northern Cyprus has an autonomous government of its own, and to even insinuate that Turkey is responsible for the policies of northern Cyprus administration. Is actually diplomatically, I think, is beyond my area of expertise. But I don't think the Turkish government is ready to accept any responsibility for what's happening in northern Cyprus.
Okay, Ali, we'll leave it there. That was Ali Şakalı, the professor of political science at Koçi University in Turkey. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment.
With bureaus in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York and Zurich, and over 25 correspondents around the world, Monocle has an experienced team of editors and journalists filing for us around the clock. From our bureau in Tokyo, Kenji Hall covers Japan and beyond.
I've kicked the tires of the Taiwanese president's motorcade, and in the span of just a couple of weeks, I've swung through more than a dozen cities across Japan, from Hiroshima to Sapporo, for Monocle's Japan Guide. The best part, though, is that I get to live in Tokyo. There's really no better city to get lost in and to mingle with world-class architects, artists, and artisans. It's a city where food and fashion are a religion, where designers like Naoto Fukasawa turn everyday products into art.
That was Monocle's Kenji Hall, our man in Tokyo.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily. With 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture, and business. Hear from experts, authors, and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
Welcome back. Now, it's every film director's worst nightmare. Your cinematic work of art fails to draw audiences to the box office, and those who do go and see it are hardly inspired. That's when you know you've got a flop on your hands. Disney's counting the cost of one as we speak. John Carter, an action flick set on Mars, is on course to lose the studio more than 150 million euros. It's hard to pinpoint exactly why the films fail to impress, but even one of the film's cast, Dominic West, admits he found John Carter hard to follow. Earlier, I spoke to film critic Karen Krzyzewanowicz to discuss the phenomenon of blockbuster flops.
John Carter was made for an estimated $250,000 budget. and that's an additional 100 million on top for marketing. Now, in order for a film to make back, even break even, it has to basically make twice that much. And generally, the reason why the first 2 weekends or the first 2 weeks or 3 weeks of a film's release is so pivotal is because it actually builds the film's brand, as it were. Because this was supposed to be one of Disney's franchises. So John Carter was made for that month, that much. And as it stands, I believe at 3 weeks, the global gross stands at $184 million.
So the chances of this being turned around now looking slim?
I would say almost impossible, actually, because unless there is a change in some sort of delivery platform. For example, let's say VOD or streaming suddenly or something happens that a lot more people want to see it on things that we haven't monetized yet, delivery systems that we don't know about, which could happen in the future. John Carter looks to be one of the biggest losses in cinematic history, even worse than Cutthroat Island, which was $187 million.
That seems like a long time ago now, doesn't
it? I know.
It,
I'd forgotten about that, actually. Mm. You have a tendency to forget things like Ishtar that was made for, I think, 55. I've got it all written down here. Made for 55 in 1987. That was a lot of money. Now that's it's a mid-budget movie. And it only made $14 million domestically. But what's interesting about that is that the international box office didn't figure into that, where international is very, very important today.
It seems to be that many of these films that do badly have a theme that's quite out there, and it's either in the past or looking at Waterworld. They're ambitious ideas and they cost a lot to produce. Mm. It's a big gamble, but they still try to do that.
Well, they're trying. I mean, Hollywood and filmmakers in general, indie filmmakers also do this. They want to give us something that's exceptional. They want to show us a different world, a world that we don't see. Mm. So not many of us are going to be living on a raft with Kevin Costner, right? You know.
So this was meant to be the new Pirates of the Caribbean.
Absolutely. Well, you mean John Carter, or Waterworks, as I call it.
Well, that did well moving forward, partially because of the attention that was drawn to its bad performance. Yeah. And you know, you have to wonder whether the same could happen for John Carter with a revived cult following almost.
Well, there is hope for a cult following, but I think that we're going to see that some years in the future, because it's going to become part of a library and its value may be realized there. With Waterworld, you have to remember that it became a cult film. And also, it's quite a good film. If you watch it now, if you didn't know anything about the budget problems and all the hoo-ha, which, of course, is affecting John Carter, the same sort of things, you wouldn't really think much of it. You think, oh, it's quite a good film, really.
Looking at the things that people are saying about John Carter, it seems to be quite undecided as to the real problems at the heart of it, whether it's the cast or the script or just everything attached to this film.
I was reading quite a few articles about it because I saw it and I quite liked it. I mean, it is derivative. I mean, now, because it's off time, and also the leading star, just even though he hops a lot.
And he's an unknown as well.
He is an unknown, and he's also not the most charismatic person in front of the camera, even though he looks great with his shirt off, which is a plus. Mm. You know, I think that there are other things to look at. Number one, Disney was very, very wary of using Mars in its title. Now, that automatically made it just John Carter. Get Carter? John Carter? What is that?
Yeah.
If you weren't reading, if you're not an aficionado, you would not know that that's based on Edgar Rice Burroughs.
No, and it would be, moving forward, it would be quite easy to muddle the two up. Why did they not want to use the word Mars?
Well, statistically speaking, and this includes the debacle that they've had with Mars Needs Moms, that went badly, badly wrong. Anything with Mars in the title, including Mars Attacks, hasn't done very well at the box
office.
There's
a theme here. Just avoid Mars films. They don't work.
Name it after another candy bar. That's what I think.
Or move to another planet, perhaps. We're done with Mars.
Why not John Carter of Barsoom? Now, why not? Because that, of course, is the name that Edgar Rice Burroughs gave to Mars.
Are we in the way films go and what's in and what's not, are we in a current stage of art house films and small budget? It goes through waves, doesn't it? And we've had an Oscar season where lower budget films have been rewarded, obviously referencing The Artist as a prime example of one that's, you know, spent a little but regained an awful lot. Is it just that the timing of this film is bad? Could it have done better later?
That's a very good point. It was released against The Lorax, which was a mid-priced film about Dr. Zeus. You can take your kids. Mm. You could all go. You didn't have to spend on a babysitter. So, yes, it had problems with its release. I think it did have marketing problems. But you have to remember that the films that we see that win the awards are not the tentpole films. They may win in smaller categories. But you've got people like Harvey Weinstein who will take a film and grab it and really market it. Mm. And it may be an okay film, but because we're all aware of it, like The Artist was lovely. It's not the greatest film I've ever seen, but it was lovely. And it was nice to have the buzz about it. Mm-hmm. And I think John Carter could have had a little bit nicer handling. But I think what Hollywood needs to look at as a business... And remember that Hollywood, I say this again and again, Hollywood is not in the business of making movies. It's in the business of making money. Mm. That they need to start reducing their production costs. So that means actors earn less, production costs go less. That means that you've got to be more creative. And in fact, a lot of films are now going back to physical effects rather than visual effects. So we're cutting down on CGI because it's very, very expensive. Doesn't look that great. Mm. I saw Hunger Games, and there are some CG animals in there, which I would have liked to have seen a real animal instead. Mm. But
it would probably have been cheaper as well.
Cheaper and faster. In fact, the new Bond film is coming out in October, and they're using models rather than CGI because it's faster.
Just looking at how Disney can and other film companies that make these films that do so terribly at the box office, what can they do to fix the damage done and heal their reputation? And how long does it take them?
Well, it's really not. I mean, Harold Vogler, who was one of my teachers at Stern, said that really Disney. They have an $8 billion capitalization. This film is a $200 million loss. It's not that big of a deal. He likens it to having a dent in your car. Disney just has to be more careful. Has to be a little bit cannier, and it's very difficult with all studios to start a new franchise. So. You've got to second guess what your audience wants, and that's the big question.
Doesn't want Mars.
Not this way, no. Not with John Carter on it, anyway.
That was Karen Krizanovich there. You're listening to Midori House. I think it's time for some music. This is Soul Killing by the Ting Tings. The Ting Tings with Soul Killing. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. Stay with us. We'll have the news headlines in just a second.
LDNTYO. NYC MT4.
Now, in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll hear what the best smelling cities of the world are. And we'll also hear what it means if Saudi Arabia decides to send female athletes to the London Olympics. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Christian. In an unfolding drama that has riveted France and the world, about 300 police, some in body armour, have cordoned off a four-storey building in a suburb of Toulouse, where the 24-year-old Muslim shooter identified as Mohamed Merah is holed up. Police say the suspect has told them he carried out his attacks to avenge the deaths of Palestinian children and because of the French army's involvement in Afghanistan. Six Zimbabwean activists convicted of airing Arab Spring videos as part of a plot against President Robert Mugabe have been fined $500 and sentenced to 420 community service hours today, a milder punishment than the 10 years jail that could have been handed out. In a major diplomatic blow for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Russia and China have now joined the Security Council in voicing support for UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan's bid to end violence that has brought Syria to the brink of civil war. Biscuit and cake makers across Europe say they are having to cut back on baking because they're short of eggs and blame a European Union ban on cross-border trade in eggs from small battery cages that are being phased out. Here, the British Finance Minister George Osborne has today cut the top rate of income tax while imposing new levies on the wealthy in a political hire Wire Act, designed to rejig the burden of austerity without wavering on plans to erase a huge budget deficit. And staying here, finally, a bunch of keys carried as the Titanic sank almost 100 years ago are expected to fetch as much as £60,000 at auction here in Wiltshire, England. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Now we head to Saudi Arabia, where it's reported the Crown Prince Nayef has approved plans to send female athletes to the London Olympics. If confirmed, it'll be the first time the ultra-conservative state has allowed women to participate in the Games. Four female athletes and three officials are reportedly being considered for inclusion, but we've yet to hear any confirmation from Saudi Arabia. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Christian Coates-Ulrichsen, a research fellow at London School of Economics and an expert in Gulf politics. Christian, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Very well. Now, this is a promising step, but should we raise our hopes until we, you know, get confirmation from the state itself?
Well, I think with every reform measure that comes out of Saudi Arabia and perhaps the wider Gulf, it's always wise to wait for the implementation and not just go along with the announcement.
Now, they're not the only country that could send females for the first time. We're also hearing that Qatar and Brunei could do so as well. But it's most surprising in Saudi Arabia because of the extensive restrictions placed on women in the country. Outline for us, you know, how women live in Saudi Arabia and how it compares to the lives of men.
Well, they live very separate lives in a way. Women, of course, are not allowed to drive. That's the international cause célèbre, although female activists started to drive last summer as a show of defiance. Women have just been told they may be given the vote in 2015, although again that hasn't been confirmed or implemented in any real meaningful manner. It's just been announced. They're kept very segregated in public spaces. Universities and all forms of teaching are strictly segregated, so very much separate and largely unequal lives.
And now the IOC has said that progress has been made in talks with Saudi officials, but they're not the only people that have been pressuring Saudi Arabia to allow women into the Games. There's been quite a lot of international pressure, hasn't there?
Well, yes. I think Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, for example, have been very active over the past year of pointing out many of the inequalities that persist in Saudi Arabia to a great and extreme degree. And I think over the last few months, as the Saudi Arabian monarchy, the government has tried to present itself as on the side of revolutionaries in Syria, somewhat bizarrely, I think that the pressure on them to at least open up, perhaps only with a gesture, is growing ever more intense because they cannot present themselves as being on the side of the people in the Syrian example when they keep their own nationals under such a surveilled society.
If this does go ahead, and according to the London-based paper, the El Hayat, where these reports of Prince Nayef's comments first emerged, Prince Nayef said that only certain sports would women be allowed to compete in, ones which met the standards of women's decency and didn't contradict Islamic laws. What can we deduce from that?
Well, yes, I suspect that you wouldn't have any Saudi swimmers, for example, in figure-hugging swimsuits. I suspect that would be beyond the pale. I would imagine that safe events, perhaps like equestrian or archery perhaps, or even table tennis, something like that, which would allow the female to participate fully clothed and perhaps obviously with covering her hair, would be considered just about acceptable. But clearly any form of more kind of showing flesh in any way would be completely, I think, unacceptable.
Comparing Saudi Arabia to the others that are considering sending women, Qatar and Brunei, there's far less sports participation amongst women, whereas in Qatar and Brunei, at least, there has been some competition allowed to women with regards to sport. With Saudi Arabia, there's been none, has there?
Well, not officially. I think women participate, but it's very much cloak and dagger. It's unofficial and it's not licensed. There's a degree of women's soccer teams, for example, but nothing at the official level, which makes you also wonder, even if they do compete, there's no real institutional mechanism by which athletes can rise to the top. So I suspect that the standard may be just very, very poor and perhaps only a token. But I think also a lot of eyebrows will have been raised at the idea that Qatar will also be sending female athletes for the first time, because I think that will surprise a lot of people, given Qatar's extremely high profile in championing the rights of people across the Arab world.
And going back to the skills of women in Saudi Arabia for sport and their suitability, as you say, a token one or two may be sent this time around. Will this signal the start of a huge tidal change now in Saudi Arabia and women from a younger age being pushed towards sport, or at least being allowed to do so if they should wish?
Well, any form of participation can generate role models and figures in society for young women and young girls to look up to. So in that respect, it should be perhaps welcomed. I think the key will be to ensure that the inequities and the kind of daily discrimination that women in Saudi Arabia face is not lost sight of with these small-scale steps at reform, and that pressure continues to be exerted and to continue to highlight some of the issues that face women and also men in many forms of daily life. So I think it's vital that we don't just kind of rest on the laurels of allowing three women to participate.
There have been very recent acts of aggression from women's groups in Saudi Arabia at the restrictions that they're under. There was one earlier this month at a university where the women called for greater resources being put into female education. Is there a growing consensus there amongst the female population that they should get more and that things must change there?
Yes, I think there is. I think women, just as much as men, are equally attuned to the technological changes sweeping across the region. They're very avid Twitter and Facebook users, for example. They're equally immersed in the dialogues with people from across the region, across the world, in fact. So the whole Arab Spring is as much of a social uprising of the mind, and I think that is definitely not bypassing people by. And as women's education grows in Saudi Arabia, as people become much more skilled in terms of participating in wider debates, which they didn't have 3-4 years ago, then of course the demands will only grow.
It's obviously hard to say for sure, but looking ahead, where will this fall in terms of compromise between what the state wants in terms of women's rights and what the women are demanding? You've got international pressure from all sides. As you say, the advent of the internet makes them more connected with the wider world. But you've got Prince Naif offering this compromise of allowing women at least to go to the Olympics. In terms of how women are treated in the country, where will there be a compromise met? How different will women's lives be?
Well, there's inevitably going to be a clash when top-down attempts to try and have a managed process of reform clash or intersect with bottom-up demands for sweeping and meaningful change. This is a token, perhaps. It's definitely not the end of the journey. As I just mentioned, the demands will keep on growing. The network society that we live in cannot insulate or isolate women from the possibilities that await them should they be able to break free of the chains that they're currently bound under. So I think that the pace and the nature of change will only speed up, or at least the demand for change, and perhaps bring into greater light some of the processes holding back that change within the kingdom itself. So Naif may become king. He is a very conservative figure within the Saudi ruling family, but the speed of social change is accelerating, and in doing so in ways outside state control, which is a qualitative difference from the past, and this will inevitably produce a kind of generational gap between the elderly rulers getting older and a population 65% under the age of 30, which is getting younger and younger and much more savvy and open to different pathways. This is what will really face the rulership with a deep conundrum in the years ahead.
Absolutely. We must leave it there. Thank you, Dr. Christian Coates-Ulrichsen, research fellow at the London School of Economics and expert in Gulf politics. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. Stay with us. We're back with a story on the preparations for the Burmese elections just after this.
With a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
in Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. It's 42 minutes past the hour here, 18:42 in London, 5:42 a.m. if you're waking up in Melbourne. Now, small signs of a breakthrough and hopes have been raised for greater transparency in Burma as the country invites American and European observers to witness next month's elections. It follows an earlier move to let in a team of delegates from the Association of Southeast Asia Nations. The election on April the 1st will see pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi stand for office for the first time since 1990 when Burma's military leaders refused to recognise her National League for Democracy Party's victory. Earlier, Monocle's Matt Barbette spoke to Preeti Nalu, a journalist from neighbouring Thailand.
Let's start with the talk of all the positive news that's been flowing out of Burma recently. There's been the release of political prisoners. Ceasefire talks have begun in ethnic areas. There's been increased freedom, especially in terms of changes in media laws. There's been formation of labor unions. Now, this does bring up the question of why the administration has changed so quickly since their inception last year, and what does this reform entail? It has become very obvious that Thein Sein, the president, and the reformers inside the administration recognize that they have to make major and substantive changes in order to bring the country out of economic isolation and in order to convince the international community that sanctions must be lifted in order for the country to advance.
Is that the root of this then? It's purely economic and not driven by, you know, a philosophical view that democracy has to happen?
Well, I have to say that the moves by the administration do come from a very pragmatic manner. The positive news behind this that the new administration is much more rational in comparison to the fully military regime that's been operating for decades. Of course, as with any nation state, economic concerns are primary in terms of decision making. But the administration does realize that the conflict needs to halt at some point and is making some level of concerted efforts towards achieving stability inside the country.
I mean, there has been no confirmation as yet from the government in Burma itself that they're going to let in observers from the US, the EU, and also the Southeast Asian nations. It's come from those individuals and those groups themselves. But, you know, someone who is very much concerned with democracy, of course, in her home country of Burma is Aung San Suu Kyi. Has there been any reaction from her yet about this move to let in observers for the election?
Well, the news is being received very positively, especially because just even less than a year ago, in November 2010, it was an impossible notion for any sort of monitors to enter the country. So Aung San Suu Kyi, the National League of Democracy, her party, has received the news quite positively, and they do feel that it will ensure free and fair elections. And to be honest, it will not be fully surprised. It will not be a surprise if Aung San Suu Kyi is granted position. She has been received with massive crowds who visited her over her election campaign, which is indicative that she might be ensured a pretty comfortable victory. And it looks like the president himself will be interested in forging an alliance with her and the NLD for the sake of gathering even more support from the international community. But what remains to be seen is how much power she will be given within this position.
I mean, it has been, as you say, quite a sort of shift in Burma. Certainly, I remember colleagues of mine, you know, going to cover Cyclone Nargis some 4 years ago, and it was very difficult for them to get into the country and very difficult for them to see the devastation that was wrought by that. I mean, what's been the change since then, Preeti, for journalists from outside wanting to cover Burma?
As a really simple example, it was pretty much impossible for me to enter the country last year ahead of elections. The administration was very closed in terms of how they approached the process. This year, they are granting short-stay visas to journalists, so it is possible for foreign journalists to enter the country. But even more significantly, many of the exile opposition media has been operating essentially in neighboring Thailand and India for decades. And they've actually been invited by the government itself and are making plans to move their offices into Yangon, the former capital. And this is an absolutely unprecedented event.
That was Thailand-based journalist Priti Nalu speaking to Monocle's Matt Barbette. You're with Midori House. Time for a song now. This is Gianna Factory, a band from Denmark, with the song Dive. Gianna Factory with Dive. Now, cities have different characteristics that can either make them more popular with inhabitants and tourists or create a bad aura. What a city looks like is obviously important, but what it smells like can also have a big effect on whether you're likely to return there or not. Joining me in the studio now is Alex McKechnie, a flavour consultant. Alex, just before the we came back, we were trying to establish what exactly your role is, what your job is, and you said yourself, it's hard to explain.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. It's essentially structuring flavors, and whether that's doing it through, say, a beverage product or a deodorant or a scent or a perfume or simply food or flavoring air. It's really about just trying to structure flavors to suit the goal.
And for you, flavor and smell very much hand in hand.
Yeah.
You yourself, you're quite sensitive to smells and senses in that way, aren't you?
Yeah, I think I do a lot of exercises to train my sense of smell and my sense of taste.
Really? How do you do that?
There's a few you can do. One, a good one is you just smell, try and just stand in one place and smell everything that's around you and try and identify it. And then you can take that the step further, which is essentially closing your eyes and trying to point in a general direction of where it's the smells from. Are coming from,
wow.
Even before you see them. So you can say, oh, there's like a hot dog stand over there, or there's coffee being roasted over there.
Yeah, yeah. What for you was the first sort of sense that was most strong? Was it taste or was it smell? What was it that came first?
I think it would have to be taste. I have a really kind of vivid memory of being young and creating a special drink, which my brother and my sister loved and always begged me to make them, and
right.
I never gave them the recipe.
I guess you've got to have a good eye, not a good eye, but a good tongue to make these nice creations that taste good and are appealing to people.
Yeah, to a certain degree. I think having a good palate is one thing, but I think it's more about understanding how flavors work and how they react to each other. I think that's far more important.
Looking at cities then, it's very much out of our control what they smell like, surely.
Yeah, I think there are ways in which humankind can affect the smell of a city. You know, if you take Mexico City, for example, had a huge pollution problem, and now they've started installing quite a revolutionary system where they filter the air, and so now the standard of living is moving up in Mexico City, you know, and so they're controlling their pollution problem, but it's more, you know, you can do lots of ways to affect an overall smell, and you can do lots of things to stop smells.
Mm. Obviously, artificially hiding the smell or removing it using like a big filter of some sort, is that desirable, or would it be better to, say, plant more trees?
I mean, I think trees are the best option because, you know, you're benefiting the earth in ways that you can help things. But some cities, it's not, you know, if you're talking about the middle of Beijing, there's not a lot of space for people to start planting trees.
You mentioned Beijing there. Are there certain cities that are suffering and have a bit of a smell problem that is stopping people from going there?
I think when, you know, an economy booms and they focus so much on building up and moving forward very quickly compared to a city which has been around for a long time and has grown steadily. You know, if you take I guess, an example of Paris versus, you know, Beijing. And you can see that Paris has been around for a lot longer. You know, there are smells in Paris which are unpleasant, you know, like alcohol, cigarettes, all that that's polluting the air. But the overall smell of Paris is quite pleasant.
And why is that? What does Paris have or do that...
Paris has a long-going baking culture. This is one thing which I particularly like about Paris is that in the morning you have this like waft of just this really nice smell of baked bread, which for me just always makes me smile.
And that's why I've got a list here of your top five best-smelling cities, and Paris is on there. But in brackets, before 10 a.m., by which time the baking smell has long faded.
Yeah, then other smells start to come in.
What else is on your list? What other cities?
Let's see. Sydney, Australia is a really good one, simply because of, I guess, cleanliness and also access to sea breezes.
Mm.
You know, having an environment which can throw winds, which can change your kind of climate is very important.
If you're not on a coastal region and your area is not known for being too breezy, what can be done to improve the smell?
Obviously planting trees I think is always good, depending on what tree you plant. I think London has a vast growth of cherry blossom going through, which in springtime scents the entire city. You get this really nice like undertone, almost base note of a perfume which just lofts around, which is sometimes a bit difficult to really get, but it's there.
Do you think humans have always been impressed by smells and odours like that? When you look at the plants that are already here and are around the world, is this obsession with fragrance a relatively new thing or is it historic?
I think, if you smell something and you like it, then your body reacts to it instantly. You know, if you smell a nice smell, you feel it from the inside out. You go like, oh, that's a nice smell, and you react to it. I don't think that that's something which, we've just developed recently.
Mm. And dare I ask, what sort of smells are you getting from this studio right now?
The biggest smell in this room is me, unfortunately. But I stink of coffee.
Coffee's not bad.
Coffee's not bad. I like a really nice smell. I guess the room has some pretty major smells. The main kind of smell is wall paint. That's kind of going through. And then it would be must from the carpet.
I'm glad you didn't say the must from anything else. Thank you so much for that. That was Alex McKechnie, a flavour consultant there, speaking of the smells of our cities. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagatja.
Monocle 24 ja Jorgoso.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Bropa Jalavet. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Well, sadly, that's all we have time for on this edition of Midori House. The show was produced by Marcus Hippy, researched by Fernando Augusto Bacheo, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. The Monocle Daily will be back at 2200 hours London time to start the day in Asia. But next on Monocle 24 is The Entrepreneurs with Jonathan Openshaw, so stay tuned for that. Headlines with Jonathan Wheatley are next. This has been Midori House. From me, Christian Yeo, and the team, goodbye. Have a lovely evening.